This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hello, this is Fiona Porter, and we're joined in the studio today by Sophia Wallström from the Institute of Astronomy, KU Leuven in Belgium.
Yes, hello.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So at the moment you are visiting the University of Manchester for ALMA.
Yes.
Care to tell us a little bit about what you're up to?
So we're working on some ALMA data of evolved stars, asymptotic giant branch stars, which are an evolved state of sun-like stars and more massive stars. So with ALMA we can resolve the matter that's ejected by these stars and see what they're up to.
So for our listeners who are not too up to date on their stellar evolution, asymptotic giant branch is what you'll see if a star is between about, I believe it's about 0.6 and 10 solar masses, is that right?
Yeah, 0.8 and 8 are the numbers we normally use, but around there. We're not sure what happens at the boundaries.
But if you get too far past 10, then you're in supernova territory.
Yes.
But we're not looking at those today.
No.
So what's ALMA looking at in particular for this project?
So with ALMA, we can look at the gas that's ejected by these stars, which we can study through the molecules that's in the gas, which emit radiation at certain frequencies that we can see in the radio and submillimeter, which is where ALMA is looking. Mm. So we're studying different molecules and how they move in the gas.
So these are going to be a property of the giant stars being, as far as stars go, not all that hot.
Yes.
Because obviously if your star is a bit too hot, then everything just gets ionized and there's not really much room to have the more complicated molecules.
Yes, that's true.
So what sort of molecules are you looking at using this?
The ones that we commonly see around AGB stars are things like carbon monoxide, which is carbon and oxygen. There's lots of that. Other oxides like silicon oxide and sulfur oxide. We are also interested in metal molecules, so things like iron oxide and aluminium oxide, which are a bit more rare.
So we're not talking astronomy metals, where it's everything other than hydrogen and helium. We're talking actual what everyone would recognise as metals.
Yes. So iron, aluminium, magnesium, titanium, those sorts of metals in simple, normally diatomic molecules. So just the metal and oxygen most commonly.
So what can we learn from these molecules?
So the reason we want to study these molecules is because they are likely to be components of the dust that also forms around these stars. So dust in the galaxy tends to be small particles, either soot-like if they have a lot of carbon or sort of sand-like if they don't. So these are not carbon-rich stars, and therefore we get silicate dust or sand-like dust. And we're pretty sure that various metals that are produced by the star help form this dust, but we don't know exactly how it happens. So by studying these stars with ALMA, we can look very close to the star at the region where we think the dust forms.
Right. So why is ALMA in particular important for this? Is it a resolution thing?
Yes. It's both angular resolution and sensitivity. So because ALMA is a combination of so many telescopes, we can look at very small details very close to the star and also have the sensitivity, the collecting area, to actually see these faint features.
So it's a combination of actually being able to see close enough to be able to isolate it to particular regions, while still actually being able to collect enough of the relevant wavelengths that you can actually tell something's there, because if you can't, then even if something is there, it's going to just be invisible to you. On a more personal level, can I ask a bit about your own research?
Yeah, so I haven't been working on AGB stars for all that long. I was studying other types of stars earlier in my PhD. The most similar topic that I've covered was more massive stars. Hmm. So I've looked at a yellow hypergiant star, which is a different form of evolved star.
And a very cool sounding one, if I may say.
Yes. So there were already supergiants, which were so named because they were more luminous than the giant stars that had already been found. And then when we find even more luminous stars, we have to keep coming up with more hyperbolic names for them. So yellow hypergiant.
Coming to you soon will be some sort of, you know, ultra giant.
Definitely.
Something very dramatic like that.
So the yellow hypergiant star that I was studying, it has thrown off a lot more mass than an AGB star is able to eject. But because, as you said, it's a much hotter star than AGB stars, it doesn't have so many complicated molecules in it. So we mostly look at it in the most abundant molecule that we can easily detect, which is carbon monoxide.
If I understand, that's because that one's quite a strong bond between the carbon and the oxygen.
Yes.
Whereas some of the other molecules, the bonds are comparatively weaker and more easily destroyed or disrupted.
Yeah. So the biggest reason carbon monoxide is the one we look at is because it is the most abundant. The overall most abundant molecule is hydrogen, so two hydrogen atoms joined as a molecule. But we can't detect that in the radio because it just doesn't emit at those frequencies. So the next most common molecule by far is carbon monoxide.
And both of those make sense. I mean, hydrogen's the most common type of atom in the universe. And meanwhile, in these stars, because they're quite late in their life, you're going to be seeing quite a bit of carbon and oxygen because they've sort of reached the point where they can fuse those from lower mass elements.
Exactly.
So when it came to this hypergiant, though, you're studying a similar sort of thing involving that it's losing mass. Is this just part of its life cycle?
Yes. So most stars, I would say, will, once they've stopped being sort of normal main sequence stars, where they're just burning hydrogen and are quite calm and quiescent, like our sun is at the moment, after they start to run out of hydrogen, their cores will contract and therefore they expand their outer layers. So in the terms of lower mass stars that become AGB stars, they will be quite large and cool and be sort of slowly losing mass. Whereas more massive stars will expand faster and still be quite hot, so they can lose mass a lot more quickly. And they also start off with more mass to lose.
How fast are we talking? Are there any numbers which are going to make sense?
So yellow hypergiants is actually an even more extremely short stage of a massive star's evolution. It only lasts a few thousand years,
which in astronomy time is nothing.
Yeah, it's a blink of an eye. But in general, the more massive stars will only live maybe 10 million years or 1 million year, whereas the lowest mass stars will live longer than the current age of the universe.
Which is really something. Our sun's sort of relatively middle of the road in terms of its temperature, if I remember rightly. It's a G-type.
Yeah.
For those of you who know your sun classification schemes. Were yellow hypergiants, is that sort of a thing that a star like the sun could become, or is that for more massive cases?
That's for more massive cases. So the sun will become a red giant when it first starts to evolve into its evolved star stage at the end of its life. Whereas more massive stars, say more than about 8 solar masses, will become red supergiants.
Oh, I see. So mass is going to be the sort of the dominating factor there.
Yes.
Makes sense. So for a different part of your research, you gave a talk earlier today about some work you've been doing with NESS, which is the Nearby Evolved Stars Survey.
Yeah. So with NESS, we're looking at the most common types of evolved stars, which is asymptotic giant branch stars. These AGB stars again. And the reason we want to look at them is because they are so common and they provide a lot of the gas and dust in our galaxy. But they haven't been studied in a systematic way because it's been difficult to observe the amount of the number of stars that you would need to get a statistical sample.
I see. Is there something about them that makes them difficult to detect, then?
Not really, but we haven't had good enough telescopes and receivers to be able to look at large number of sources in a reasonable amount of time. So people have mostly looked at single sources or a smaller sample of sources.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. What sort of waveband are they brightest in? Obviously, they're visible in the radio for when you're looking for molecules. But the stars themselves, is that the best place to look?
The stars themselves tend to be brightest in the infrared because they're quite large and cool stars. But when you look in the infrared, you're generally just looking at continuum or photometry. So you're only getting a single measurement of the brightness of the star at a certain wave band.
Oh, I see. Rather than actually getting a look at any of the structure involved.
Yes.
And of course, with infrared, you've also got the issues of things like extinction.
Yes.
Because obviously you're going to be in a dusty environment, which means a lot of that light just isn't going to make it to us.
Yeah.
So how many of these stars is NESS looking at then?
We have a sample of about 500 stars within 2 kiloparsecs of the Sun.
How's that compare to any of the other studies?
Most studies haven't tried to do such a systematic look. People have mostly just gone for the brightest sources that are the easiest to detect or sources that are special in some way.
Whereas yours is more sort of like a general view of it all.
Yeah, we want to look at all the AGB stars within a certain volume of the galaxy.
What sort of trends are you looking for?
So we're assuming that there will be trends with mass loss rate, because that's a big obvious one, and also things like chemical type. And then other stellar parameters that we're looking at are the luminosity of the star, the temperature of the star, and the surface gravity, though we don't have measurements of that for all the sources.
I'm not actually familiar with surface gravity. Would you mind explaining what that is?
I don't actually know how people measure it, but it's basically a measure of how tightly bound the outer layers of the star are.
Oh.
So if your star gets too big, then the outer layers essentially don't feel any gravity from the star because they're just too far out. So the random movement of the material is larger than the surface, the gravity that the star exerts.
I see. I suppose that's going to be relevant in a case where you're losing mass, isn't it?
Yes. We think that's part of why AGB stars are losing mass, because they have pulsations coming from the inner core and traveling out into the outer layers of the star, lifting the layers further away from the core until they become, able to escape the surface gravity, essentially.
At which point they go out and join the interstellar medium then, I suppose.
Yeah, slowly but surely.
So the data that you're using to do these studies, is that complete? Is NESS all finished collecting data?
No, not yet. So we have a large observing program with the JCMT telescope, the James Clerk Maxwell telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which is doing both molecular and continuum observations in the submillimeter. And that's about 60% done at the moment. So the observing program will run over about another 2 years.
Are you expecting to find sort of a similar proportion of sources in the future? So if you've currently got about 500, are we expecting maybe another whatever 40% of 500 is more?
No, 500 is the total number of sources that we're targeting. So they're chosen from a different catalogue.
Right, so that's going to be 500 total in the end, but currently you don't have full measurements of all of them.
Yes.
Right, that makes sense. How are the results looking so far? Are they about what you expected?
Well, what I've looked at so far is mostly the carbon monoxide lines, so the data that we have on the gas. And I've been comparing it to previously observed samples and also to models that people have done of AGB stars of what they expect to see. And so far, we're not quite matching the models, and we're not sure why. But we haven't done a proper calculation of various parameters from the data. We've just done a sort of first step, rough and ready calculation. So there's still quite large error bars in what we're doing.
So it's a little bit too back of the envelope to conclusively say there's something a bit weird going on here.
Yeah, we definitely can't conclusively say much.
Well, it's still early days though.
Yeah.
But of course, we all know that what astronomy is really about is pretty pictures.
Yes,
so,
of course.
So I understand that you do actually have some images of essentially what the structure looks like around these stars.
Yes. So especially with the JCMT, it's built to be a survey telescope or a mapping telescope. So it's able to map an area in a very short amount of time. So we're getting some very nice pictures of the cold dust around some of these stars. And this is something that hasn't been very extensively studied before, because we haven't always had these instruments available at the sort of sensitivities they can reach now.
What's the sort of thing you see with this? Is dust sort of, I guess, clustered around the stars like a ring, or...?
Yeah, we don't really have the angular resolution to get a lot of small-scale features. So we mostly see rings of dust around the stars. We see some slight asymmetries in some of them, which is interesting and sort of expected. A lot of AGB stars are expected to be in binary systems, so they have a companion which would shape the ejecta that they're throwing off, the matter that they're ejecting.
Well, that makes sense, I suppose. So would that be another star, or would a big enough planet work?
Both would work.
So what you're seeing then, I guess, is effectively the companion sort of passing through some of all this dust and just disrupting it a bit.
Yeah. There's different mechanisms for how a companion might affect the outflow of the material, depending on how close it is and how massive it is.
But this isn't usually going to be a situation where you're going to be forming new planets?
No. The densities aren't really high enough for the dust to club together and form new planets. It's mostly existing stars or planets that are just shaping what we see.
At least gives you something nice to look at.
Yes.
Well, it's been very good to have you here, Sophia.
Thank you.
Thanks for speaking with us, and bye for now.
Bye.